The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomon. On this week's show, we talk to the great actor Paul Giamatti about the art of wrestling and life in his new film, Win Win. And just like London buses, you wait years for a great cricket documentary and two come along at once. A few weeks ago, we discussed Ian Botham in From the Ashes. And this week, Fire in Babylon celebrates the great West Indies team of the early 1980s. Director Stephen Riley will be telling us why the Windies were the coolest cricket team ever. Sam Brooks will be along to help me review some of this week's releases, including Return of the Hangover, it's Hangover 2, and A Shepherd's Tale in Le Quattro Volte. And we'll be digesting Sunday's Cannes Awards announcements. Yes, it's the hair of the dog, or maybe it's a goat. It's Film Weekly.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. This kid is good, so, you know, you just be ready out there.
Can you give me a slap?
What?
Give me a slap across the face, like you're trying to wake me up.
Uh-huh. Okay, like that?
Yeah, but a little harder.
That was Paul Giamatti as Mike Flaherty, a small-time New Jersey lawyer and part-time wrestling coach with his newfound wrestling prodigy, Kyle, played by newcomer Alex Schaffer, in a scene from Tom McCarthy's new film, Win Win. The film is a moral comic drama focusing on Giamatti's Mike's attempt to survive the economic downturn and offering him a chance to turn around a failing high school wrestling team. It's a witty, unsentimental look at suburban life in America today, with a strong ensemble cast including Oscar nominee Amy Ryan and the late character actor Burt Young, best known as Paulie in the Rocky films. Film Weekly's producer Jason Phipps spoke to Paul Giamatti and started out by putting it to him that the heart of this film revolved around a crisis in American masculinity and the struggle by men to gain control of their own lives.
I would absolutely agree. I think that's right on. I mean, and it's so much of the movie. I mean, it's even stated in the movie that it's about control. I mean, he says to me he's in control and that's what feels so good, and I tell him to stay in control, and I'm losing control. And yeah, and certainly Bert's character is physically losing control. Things are out of his grasp that he, you know, that have nothing, it's his brain chemistry is out of his control. But he was clearly a guy, it suggested, who had a kind of iron control over a woman, too, in the movie at some point in his life. So yeah, I mean, the whole movie is a bit about getting a grip or letting go of stuff too. So I think that's just dead on what you said. Yeah.
I mean, that's how it came across to me. It also came across to me that control, it's also quintessentially a dilemma of the actor to some extent.
It's very interesting. And you know, it's performance, it's true. And the kid, Alex, who plays Kyle,
he's a complete newcomer.
Interesting instance of, he's not even an actor. I mean, he's actually a champion high school wrestler. He's the best wrestler in his weight class in New Jersey, which makes him in the country one of the best high school wrestlers in the country. And he is a performer, too, actually, which is why I think he took to the acting thing so well. But, you know, he's a guy who it's remarkable to see the kind of physical genius he has to control his body and to control a wrestling situation. And he's interesting to watch as an actor because he's very contained and controlled. I don't know if he knew what the hell he was doing. He'd tell you he didn't really know what the hell he was doing. But I think he had a natural aptitude from it because he's coming from a place of great control to begin with.
There's also a beautiful analogy between wrestling, which is one of the oldest forms of sports, and also maybe one of the most intimate forms of sport, with the intimacy of and the battling of family life. But you seem to bring a real knowledge of that subtle, imperfect negotiation in family life. There's great performances there.
Yeah. I think it is always imperfect, you know. I mean, but I think that it's true. I think that the metaphor, and I think I think it is a beautiful metaphor and beautifully done, in that I don't think it's ever hit over the head as a metaphor for the whole thing, but it's definitely in there. All the people sort of struggling to make the best of an imperfect situation, yeah. And you know, sure, marriage is certainly one of those.
Yeah, I can vouch for that. It's a great ensemble piece of acting, as wonderful as your performance is, your central performance is.
Yeah, oh yeah.
There isn't a bad performance anywhere in it. And do you think that Tom McCarthy, who's a very fine filmmaker and a very fine actor, do you think that he brought this amazing understanding of how to pull actors together to make that happen?
Definitely. Because he's an actor, and a really good actor, and a really good director, you know, he has a lot of compassion for actors. And, you know, I mean, he understands it. He understands the things that are hard about it. He understands the problems you're going to run into, the things that are going to be more difficult. So he's incredibly empathetic about it. And so he's also very open to people having, you know, difficulties with something and how they're going to need to work it out. And people, you know, working with the script. And yeah, he's just very fluid and open with the whole thing, process with actors.
This is also a story close to his heart, I believe. He's a Jersey boy. It's a milieu that he connects with. I read that one of the first things that really impressed upon you was that it was a very, it wasn't a cynical view of suburbia or suburban life. It tries to not dwell on that or suburbia as some sort of like political comment.
No, exactly. It's not. I was very taken with that when I first read it, because I've often bitched a lot about how, why can't somebody not put some kind of political spin on a view of American suburbia, where you're either sentimentalizing the hell out of it or you're making it this grotesque bed of just, you know, sin and vice and horror. And, you know, there's got to be some way to actually sort of show it as, you know, these people are content and functional and they're happy and they're not, you know, secretly Nazi sadists or whatever. I mean, you know, there's a way to present this or look at it and just see it for what it is. And it's not satirical and it's not sentimentalizing. I thought that's an interesting thing to try to do in America, because I think people are very used. You know, it's funny, this movie keeps getting compared to Little Miss Sunshine, which I find baffling, because I couldn't think of a more different movie from this movie. And that's a great movie, but that's very much one that takes a kind of jaundiced view of suburbia.
The great moment in the film is when you turn to Kyle, Mike Flaherty, the character you play, turns to Kyle and say, after he wins an amazing match, and you say to him, what's it like to be that good? What's it like?
Right.
And he says, he says it very matter-of-factly, it's the closest thing he gets to control.
Right.
And I know this has been put to you before, but for an actor, one of the finest actors of your generation, what's it like to be so good at what you do?
I wish I could feel, I wish I could take ownership of that. I mean, it's a very nice thing to have somebody to say to me. I mean, I would love to be able to feel the control that kid has. I think it's just, you know, as much as it was a line written for the kid, it's a sincere feeling he probably actually has.
Mm.
I just feel lucky that I get, you know, a chance to do things like this. I feel very lucky. That's how I feel, frankly.
Thank you very much, Paul Giamatti.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks to Paul Giamatti and Jason Phipps there. Win Win is on general release around the UK. Now, if Paul Giamatti were ever to play a film critic, I think he would be the one to embody the life of Zan Brooks. He looks exactly like you, Zan. Have you ever wondered that?
We've got the same sort of vibe, haven't we?
Yeah,
the same sort of slightly prickly, but nerdy.
Yeah, and dishevelled a bit. Slightly, you know, amiable loser.
Yeah.
Is that right?
And a great kind of shining beauty.
Yeah,
well,
exactly. And a dignity that really
comes
through.
Oh, yeah, and integrity.
And a touch of
the
everyman.
We just keep going talking about me.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul's in Win-Win. And we're on a winning streak, because we did quite well with our Cannes predictions. You were saying that the Tree of Life would win the Palme d'Or in our Cannes podcast last week.
Was I? I can't even remember.
Where you
were. I think I just kind of said everything.
Yeah, the Tree of Life was a hedged bet, if one could extend the garden
producer
metaphor.
Would kind of be kind to me and pick what he thought.
And it did. And you're pleased about that, presumably, because you were sort of pantheistically enthusiastic about it.
I absolutely adored it. I'm now kind of braced for the inevitable backlash. I mean, it was a film that split audiences when it did screen. Now it's won the Palme d'Or, and I'm sure there's going to be a big backlash where people are saying it's the sort of art house Forrest Gump. It's kind of spiritual eyewash.
It's opening totally in. Empty. I noticed that Brad Pitt was at its premiere in Hollywood only last night, so I assume it's opening in the US pretty soon.
Yeah, and I think it's opened in France already, hasn't
right.
it?
Right, and is it ever going to open in England?
We still don't know. This is
or
it.
Britain, I should
say. But I think kind of head over on the Eurostar to Paris, if not, it's worth seeing.
To catch it, absolutely. Otherwise, there were awards for the artist. There are awards for a film that we haven't covered here, and I know Cannes is long gone, but there was a film in it, which I thought was quite extraordinary, that did win the second prize, shared it, ex aequo, yeah. as they say in France, with the Dardenne brothers, Girl on a Bike, and it was Nuri Bilge Ceylan's Turkish thriller, I suppose,
thriller,
procedural,
yeah. exactly.
called Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, a film that I tipped to win the Palme d'Or,
yeah.
so I just missed out myself.
You tipped it sight unseen, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I did. And then I saw it, 2 hours, 37
minutes. I thought this was the best film that he's done so far.
Yeah, me too.
And you're right, it is a sort of procedural thriller, but it's done very much in the Chelan style. This would have been a worthy winner too.
Wouldn't it?
I thought it was a very good competition. There were about 4 or 5 films that I would have been very happy to see win the Palme d'Or.
Yeah, I know, you wouldn't have been ashamed of as well. I thought that the Nuri Bilge one was the most typical. If you looked at the last 10 years of Palme d'Ors, this would have fitted it.
It would,
know.
Yeah. And they couldn't give it to the Dardennes because they'd won it sort of twice before.
Yeah.
You know, obvious omissions from the winning roster were the Almodovar, the skin I live in, which I thought was terrific.
And it got nada.
Nada. And the Lynn Ramsey, we need to talk about Kevin, which I think maybe had the fatal thing of screening too early. It was like the sort of the first film off the rank, wasn't
yeah.
it? And by the time, 10 days later, it might as well have been made back in 1943. people had just totally forgotten it.
Yeah, although they remembered My Wen's Police, which...
they did, and that was a curious choice.
Yeah, I like it, so I'm happy to see it again. I don't love it, but I thought Lynn Ramsey might get something, even maybe Best Director or something
yeah.
like that, which went to Nicholas Winding Refn, friend of the show. So that was Cannes, which we thought was good.
I thought it was great, and... The script was kind of a very nice dramatic script, wasn't it? You had the kind of good versus evil. You had the beginning of the world and the end of the world.
Oh, yeah, the script of Cannes, in a way.
The script of Cannes. Yeah. You had you had Terrence Malick playing God, who never actually showed up, but he was out there somewhere, and you know, everybody worshipped him. And Lars von Trier playing the devil, who was kind of cast out after his remarks at the press conference. So it had a nice kind of biblical flavour.
It did, didn't it? And we were just the little...
And we were, what were we? We
little
were just
imps. Forced to run in Manichaean
darkness. No, we were the apostles, weren't we?
We're the apostles.
Apostles.
Oh, yes, because we rewrote the letters, I suppose.
Exactly,
right, absolutely.
Yeah.
I didn't have a Damascene conversion anyway along the line.
No, you didn't.
What you do is you have...
I drank a lot of wine, though.
Yeah, you did, a rosé kind of conversion. Now, Zan, when you get back from Cannes, it's always very difficult, I think, to kind of then kind of immerse yourself in the weekly grind. But I think this week we've got some interesting things because you've got a sort of Cannes mix in here.
Yeah.
We've got a film that was a big hit at last year's Cannes,
yes.
coming out this week, which we'll talk about, Le Quattro Volti. We've also got The Hangover 2.
Yeah, which is sort of appropriate in a different way, isn't it?
Because we have both got hangovers. So let's start with Hangover 2, a film which I missed, I have to say. I like to see in France that this is not called La Gueule de Bois 2, it's called Un Very Bad Trip.
Yeah, another very bad trip.
Yeah, yes, another very bad trip.
Une autre. Yes, so I guess they just don't have hangovers there, do they?
No.
It's not a French thing.
They don't drink to get drunk, they drink to enjoy.
It's a Scandinavian, it's a sort of Anglo-Saxon
yeah,
Scandinavian
exactly.
thing. This is a very appropriate for this film too, because it is like a hangover from the first Hangover, which I kind of enjoyed. I thought the first Hangover was a lot of fun.
Yeah, we had
really.
The director Todd Phillips, so much fun, didn't I? I thought, well, let's get a comic director on. And he was good, and it was a good comedy.
It was
surprisingly good
and
comedy.
And it was a sort of breakout hit. It was apparently the most successful R-rated film.
And it made
US.
Stars of Zach Galifianakis, yeah. Bradley Cooper, and those other two blokes who I can't remember.
Yeah, who aren't stars anymore.
Ed Helms is one of them.
Mike Tyson?
Yeah,
is that
that's
the one?
It, and a tiger, and a chicken.
Oh, look who it is. So what do you think?
Well, I'm sorry?
The tattoo? You love it?
No. Actually, I hate it.
No refunds.
No, we don't want any refunds. We just have a couple of questions. We're trying to figure out what went down last night.
What went down? Take a look what you did outside. Half the neighborhood went down.
We did that?
You don't remember getting into a bar fight at the White Lion?
We don't remember anything.
Oh, boy.
This is basically the film done over again. I mean, it is... almost to a I'm going to say comical degree, but it's not funny, so it's not really comical. It's almost like they've submitted the script and scratched out the words Las Vegas and replaced it with Bangkok.
Right, so they go like in some bad BBC sitcom where they kind of used it for the film version, took them abroad. They've taken them to
exactly.
Thailand.
It's on the buses, goes Bangkok. It's the character of Stu, played by Ed Helms, is getting married to a lovely girl out in Thailand, and they go out there. They lose her teenage brother, goes missing, leaving just a sort of severed finger behind. So they have another stag do. They come to wondering what the hell happened, and it's basically the same film.
No.
It's basically the same film.
Really? Because, I mean, I haven't seen it. They actually do a hangover, and they can't remember what happened. They have to piece it together again.
Yeah.
Well, that's rubbish.
Yeah, it is rubbish. It is like a kind of a terrible karaoke version of The Hangover, where they're all slightly more inebriated, slightly louder, slightly more desperate. And it just goes on and on and on. Instead of the tiger, you've got a chain-smoking monkey.
Oh, right. Well, that's funny.
You've got Mike Tyson back in.
He's not in Thailand now, is he?
Well, you know, I don't want to give too much away. But watch out for
Mike.
For
I mean, really, I didn't know it would be quite such a bad retread.
It's quite cynical.
And I think that's... I would not go and see this.
I think please don't. Please don't.
That we talked about Cannes, and one of the films that was a success at last year's Cannes was an Italian film by Michelangelo Frammentino called Le Quattro Volti. It was a film when I was complaining about Cannes last year being very bad. Everyone said, yeah, but you didn't see Le Quattro Volti.
Yeah, I didn't see it either.
It's a film about a goat. And I was like, if a film about a goat can save Cannes, then it's not a great Cannes. So this is a very, what I would call, Italians are quite famous for espousing slow cooking when you go around Italy having stews and things like that. Yeah. They take time over their vegetables. This seems to me the sort of filmic equivalent.
Yeah, it's slow living, this film. It's based on, I'm making it sound like I knew this going in, but I didn't. It's based on the Pythagoras theory, which is a kind of fourfold transmigration, it's called. And it's a sort of karmic life cycle, where the soul goes from human to animal to vegetable to mineral. Have I lost you?
I missed it. It sounds very Terence Malickian.
It is a little bit Terence Malickian, and it has got the Tree of Life in there as well. I mean, it doesn't look like the Tree of Life that Malick gives us, but it is another Tree of Life. So clearly they're everywhere, these
So these
trees.
Are Le Quattro Volti, the four
Yeah,
steps,
the four turns, the four times, yeah, something exactly. like that. And this is where we're all travelling. I think I'm on mineral now.
Right.
I think I've done the veg and I've moved on.
Because I saw it as a sort of Vivaldi Four Seasons kind of thing.
Yeah, that's sort of trashy though, isn't it?
It is a bit sort of
slightly
as Nigel
more
Kennedy can do.
Transcendental.
That. Right. It is about a goat or herd.
It's about a village. It's about the rituals and the rhythms of the season in a small community in Calabria in southern Italy. So it starts with a goat herd, an aged goat herd, who self-medicates by basically making a little concoction up with water and the dust that he gathers from his local church.
Yeah, I couldn't work out what he was doing there.
Yeah, that's what he's doing. Yeah. And it, you know, he looks good on it. And then promptly drops dead.
Yes, he does.
So maybe it's not working
not
as well.
Not exactly
as
a spoiler, but...
And then I guess we follow his soul through various other incarnations. Yeah. But it's not really about that. It's one of those where there's no dialogue. It's incredibly just observing these things, and it's a great animal movie. It's got a fantastic, I think, like 10-15 minute sequence in there with the goat herd's collie dog basically getting in the way of these villagers who are putting on a passion play at Easter time, and it's just superbly done. I'm making it sound like the most obscure, self-indulgent, abstract bit of kind of
it is quite
art wankery,
obscure,
but it's incredibly light and jubilant.
Well, it is very light. I mean, it sort of is a bit of an art house kind of thing, as you say it is. But it is also a little bit like one of those Disney films where the little kind of cat and Milo and what's it going make their journey, voiced by
Incredible
Dudley
Moore.
Journey. Yeah,
yeah.
It is a bit like that.
It is a little bit like that.
So I'm pricking your Pythagorean art house bubble.
Yeah, but the Incredible Journey was Pythagorean as well.
Well, it was brilliant, the Incredible Journey. Good, yeah. It marked us.
Yeah. With the,
so was the cat from outer space.
Yeah, with the blind cat and the little boxer
little
dog.
Colic. Yeah, that was good. So the Quattro Volti, I mean, I know.
You hated it.
I didn't hate it. I just thought this would not have saved
my
cat.
Because you haven't moved to the vegetative state yet.
I believe I've been through that. I am now spiritual. I didn't hate it. I just thought, I know where this is going, even though
I didn't know it was going. You didn't know it was going to Mineral. You had no idea.
I still don't know it's gone to Mineral. Then you the can't tree say goes that, up. And I just kept thinking, because it reminded me of that village where George Clooney shot The American, which was in Abruzzo. Yeah. And I kept thinking he would kind of turn up any minute and kind of assassinate
people. That's the fifth
people.
State.
Yeah,
George Clooney.
I was looking for that. So you recommend it and love it?
I really liked it. And I think maybe I came back from Cannes absolutely blasted, purely in a sort of cabbage state. Mm. And thought, I don't really want to go and see any films at all for about 6 months. And I went and saw this and I thought, that's actually exactly what I needed.
Oh, right, okay.
It was a kind of strange, curious journey through the four turns.
Now, the reason that I'm foregrounding this film and showcasing it is, A, because it's probably the film of the week in some kind of bizarre world.
It's the film of the life.
And it's... What it shows me is that we go to Cannes and we kind of go, oh my God, that film's really important. And then they sort of eventually come out about a year later. I mean, over the last couple of weeks, we had A Screaming Man from Mohamed Sarun. We've had another film out this week called Life Above All by Oliver Schmitz, which was in Cannes last year. They sort of come out eventually a year later, or in the hubbub of the general releases against The Hangovers and against The Wimpy Kids and all that.
Yeah.
And you kind of go... They sort of lose a lot of their luster by not being in Cannes.
I think that's true.
Does Cannes give them what artistic? What I'm saying is the framing.
You're
of
right.
Gives it
it's almost like a race,
density.
Isn't it? Where they've almost been lapped by the Cannes of now that's coming around, and that's what we're talking about. And this is now 12 months in the past. Maybe those films do need to be kind of rushed out while people are still excited about them. It's a hard sell. I can't imagine saying to my aunt, say, go and see this film, it's great because it's about how we go from human to mineral in four stages. That's not going to cut it for her at all. But I think that there's room for these strange little slow cooking delicacies, and this is one of the better ones, and I liked it.
Thank you, Zan, for all of Zan's work in text and video form. Go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film. It seems like only a few boundaries ago that we were pondering the brilliance of Ian Botham in From the Ashes, a documentary celebrating the 1981 win by England over Australia in the Ashes. But in quick succession and joining it at the crease as a perfect companion piece this week is the release of Fire in Babylon, the story of the great West Indian cricket players of the late 1970s and early 80s.
I can remember Clive said, never again. If we can find some fast bowlers who are just as quick as they are or even quicker, let us see how well they handle it.
Clive Lloyd took a very blunt decision. We can also play your game. So he needed very fast bowlers. And he went through the Caribbean looking for players to fit into his machine.
Lovely cricket, man. I miss the people.
That is the work of director Stephen Riley, and I'm delighted to say that Stephen, in his whites, joins me in the studio now to tell me more about Fire in Babylon. Congratulations, Stephen.
Thank you.
I've been a big fan of this film ever since I saw it at the LFF ages ago, last year even. And I'm delighted to see it coming out now, exploding onto the scene. I suppose this is the time to release a cricket documentary because it's summer.
Yeah, exactly. Summer's coming out, so you can get the Pims out. Watch Fire in Babylon. So it sounds like a perfect day in.
Yeah, I wish there was a cinema that you'd have Pims and watch it. Because, I mean, it's a funny thing about this. I do think it's very much to be seen in the cinema because you can cheer with people. It's one of those ones that had me out of my seat. And I don't even like cricket.
It was actually doing the screening in the West Indies, so I took it out to Kingston for a West Indian premiere, and there was a few others that happened out in the islands. And one I went to, people were really heckling. It's really strange, the kind of there's no divide there between, you know, either audience but a performer, or kind of a sense of kind of like decorum within, if you go to a cinema or a theatre. So people were sort of chucking their comments and clapping and cheering. It was great out there.
Yeah, it's weird because, I mean, obviously I'm an Englishman. I suppose I should support the English in this, but they're the ones who are getting whooped, and I, you know, completely supporting the West Indies in this. Why is that?
Do you know, well, I remember when I first got into cricket was through watching the West Indies, and I was a West Indies fan. I was actually watching the West Indies play against England. I was supporting the West Indies, and I think that was the case for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, they went over a lot of neutrals and brought a lot of people into the game, got a lot of people interested in the game. So they're a bit like Brazil, the football team, I think, in that respect.
Absolutely. I mean, your film charts them from when they were Calypso cricketers, when they were sort of a bit of a joke team that the colonials would turn up and kind of whoop them in their own yard. And it suddenly took a kind of a sort of flash of lightning from Clive Lloyd to kind of go, right, I'm going to unite this team. I'm going to make a strong team. Is he really the man that kind of started it all off? Is he the architect of this kind of dominating team, which then dominated for the next sort of 20 years.
It's strange because when you speak to Clive, he's very mild-mannered, very modest, kind of softly spoken. But, you know, you ask anyone and they say that Clive was the architect. You know, he was a very kind of shrewd. He was a real, you know, he used to sort of, you know, retreat into himself and do all the thinking. But, you know, it was him. He decided, let's do something very bold here. You know, there had been teams of fast bowlers before, but, you know, he really just pushed that all-out pace attack. And that's what was so thrilling about them.
It's funny, isn't it? Because, as I say, I'm not a massive cricket fan, but the names from Malcolm Marshall, Gordon Greenidge, Curtly Ambrose, Viv Richards, Clive Lloyd, these dominate the sound of one's childhood. Even if you never really knew what was going on, they're on the radio all the time, you know, test match updates. They are kind of iconic figures from not just sport, but I think culturally too. And that's really where your film kind of excels and kind of becomes not a cricket documentary. It is much more of a cultural document.
It's true. And I think people were kind of, even at the time, you know, recognised the West Indies were representing something more significant than just, you know, a mere cricket team. You know, they actually were, you know, kind of transcendent even within the, you know, the 70s and 80s. You know, their influence was recognised beyond, you know, the boundary and the cricket pitch. There were, you know, this is a time, obviously, in the UK, you had race riots in the 70s, you know, Brixton riots, you know, Tottenham riots and what have you in the early 80s too. And you know, and it was these things were running in parallel. Then you'd have the kind of the big test match in 84 where the West Indies, you know, thrashed the England 5-0.
The Blackwash
series, yeah, which was, you know, unprecedented and was a kind of the apogee really of that team. You know, for you know, it was always kind of hopeful. It's predicted in the 1920s, actually. There's a real sort of romantic writing of this one cricketer, Leary Constantine, who said that, you know, his dream was that there'd be a, you know, a black team with a black captain who would go to England and defeat the English, you know, one day. And that was realised, really. And that was it took a, you know, a while and a lot of change and political change on and off the field.
There's a wonderful quote in it where, I can't remember, he sort of said, but 11 black men together wasn't a cricket team. It was known as a gang. And until Clive Lloyd kind of got them together and showed that there was thinking involved, and it was probably because it was cricket rather than sort of a more physical sport that they could do it in cricket. So was there very much this kind of element of that fueled them? There was this fire that actually fueled them and sort of said, yes, we are going to overthrow these kind of arrogant masters.
I think there was, you know, something very deep-seated there. You've got to remember, you know, that this team, and what I think defined them was that they were a bunch of youngsters, you know, apart from the captain, Clive Lloyd, and his deputy, they were all like kind of kids, effectively. And they'd, you know, as mentioned by one of the players, they were born in colonial times, you know, kind of like under subjugation of the British. But they grew up in a time of independence. So in the 60s, a lot of these islands got their independence. And so you're starting from year naught there. And, you know, I mean, we've got all these kind of, you know, historical touchstones of Agincourt and, you know, Waterloo and all these things we can kind of, you know,
and the Battle of Britain.
You
even,
can show your back tattoo of a bulldog, you know, too, if you want to go that way. But, you know, the West Indies, they kind of, they look back on quite a tortured time, you know, where it goes back 500 years to slave period. And, you know, what have you got to look to? What are your kind of like what's your focus of pride and ambition? And I think this team was really trying to make history there. And their examples served, you know, went much more, you know, broadly than the West Indies.
I mean, you said it served as a kind of beacon for apartheid struggle as well, especially with South Africa and the boycott thing that was going on at the time. But, I mean, apartheid kind of saw this black team being successful. And American civil rights, I assume, as well. They were kind of a banner, even though America doesn't really know about cricket.
Would you know, it was a really significant time for the entire black diaspora. You know, all of the displaced peoples of Africa were kind of reuniting at that time in the Roots Movement, you know, the lyrics of Bob Marley, all those other artists who were talking about, you know, looking back to your roots, you know, not looking without any shame, you know, because in the West Indies, people would, you know, even at that time, you know, if you said to a West Indian that you're African, they'd have, you know, probably, you know, reacted badly to it. It wasn't a source of, you know, kind of pride or ancestry or identity. And this is an important part of them embracing their identity, you know, within this Pan-African movement, reconnecting with Africa and becoming whole again and recognising that they could actually, you know, they had a great, a proud heritage to live up to.
Extraordinary. There is a bit where Bob Marley went in the dressing room, didn't he, with the team?
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of people, this was it. I was quite, because I always knew as Bob Marley as a football fan.
But yeah.
I mean, it actually stands to reason that you can't be a West Indian and not like cricket, because they all love the cricket. And speaking to Bunny Wailer, who's in the film, He was telling me that, you know, that Bob was a huge cricket fan. Used to kind of play. They used to play as a, you know, as kids in 8 Mile up in North Jamaica, and that Bob was actually a real kind of like. He said he could have played for the West Indies. Bob, he was that good in terms of his batting and bowling.
Wow.
And it's a very funny interview with Bunny. He's great, and he really kind of, you know, kind of a. He actually wanted to wear his cricket whites for the interview, and he told me this. He goes, "Yeah, I'll wear the whites if you want." I go, "Is this for real?" I go, "You know, definitely. We can sort that out." In the end, we were chasing the sunlight, and he wanted to go to the other side of town to get his cricket whites on. I said, "No, Bunny, look, we've got to, you know, come back."
You'd never see him again.
Yeah, exactly. I thought we're going to have to do this at midnight if we're not careful.
You had a lot of fun, clearly, making it, and it does come across in the film. I think it's infectious. I think it's brilliant. It had me out of my seat cheering. I really think it's a brilliant sports doc because it doesn't forget how exciting sport is, really, when it's played at its highest, and it is sort of, you know, a kind of apogee of human expression, and that's what comes to me through these guys and the way you've kind of, you know, skewed it as a thesis.
Well, it's great. I mean, actually, you've got the West Indian spirit in there, you know, and actually in their other export, One Love, which is, you know, kind of, you know, where the film heads to.
Yeah.
You've got all the elements to work with. It was great fun.
Yeah, the red, green and gold. I think it's great. Just to remind me, remind the listeners that the reason that you're getting quite good at this is because your first film was Blue Blood, about the underdogs of the Oxford University Blues boxing team as well, which I very much enjoyed.
Yeah, there was. I think that's maybe why I was pulled in to do this. I'm hoping I'll sort of get myself away from
yes,
sports as well eventually as well. But you know, they were kind of. It's similar in as much as they're about kind of, I guess, conservative institutions. But it was nice to kind of give them a different edge. You know, they both kind of had it was nice to be able to put a new spin on them, a modern take.
It's interesting you mentioned sports docs. They're growing at the moment. There seems to be a lot of sports docs. There was a piece in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago about the kind of growing cinematic kind of exploitation of sport as this kind of spectacle. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's working through the documentary so well?
I think that, you know, there's an inherent emotion or, you know, the interesting motivations within sports, you know, individually on a team level. And then when you can kind of, I mean, say, for example, you know, with Fire and Babylon, when you've got like kind of larger movements at play, you know, things going on in sort of the social, political, cultural sphere, you know, these things layer up really nicely. And then you've got a sense of finale and climax that sports offers, you know, in terms of the actual contest on the pitch.
Well, Fire and Babylon does all of that, Stephen Riley. Congratulations on it. It is currently, you know, it's right up there in my favourite films of the year. So hopefully by the end, I think Blue Blood actually made
there.
It in there, but I think it will stay there. I think it'll be like a Brian Lara type kind of innings, and it won't be shifted by the end of the year. Fire in Babylon. Congratulations, Stephen Riley. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you.
And that is where we have to up stumps for this edition of the show. Thanks to Stephen Riley and all my guests this week. The music we've been featuring in the podcast this week is the Latin-infused soundtrack to Emilio Estevez's new film, The Way. The music's by Tyler Bates. Don't forget to pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for all the best news and reviews, and of course my trailer trash column. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye until next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.